I just, before we go, do folks know how long we have this space or how much we've kind of agreed to?
Till 10 o'clock.
45 minutes.
Wow. Okay, no, I mean, that's fine, that's good, that's just a long time for people to
for
sit
me
in the room.
Now.
No, I'm looking around thinking, like, well, we'll revisit, let's revisit at quarter to 10
right
where
now,
our energy is. No, because a lot of people have traveled, like, 10, 12, however many hours to get here, that, you know,
everybody
2 hours might be much.
With me.
Let's just revisit. No,
I'm feeling really tired, you know.
No, you know what, I just want to say, I should have said this earlier, or we could say it at the end or whatever, but I think that this idea of, like, debate or polemic, kind of bringing back debate, I'm bringing back, but it doesn't happen in the same way. I think it's a really good thing. You're not you're a bit in the hot seat, and it's a great thing to be doing, though. And there's this great history of debate in our movements, and to kind of encourage that is a good thing, even if you're kind of hearing a lot about it. No, okay, yeah.
Oh yeah, as you were still talking, right? You mentioned about like how the war started, like in the 68. Well, actually, it was in 66 to 1975, but then even though there was still like anti, you thought that it's one time the anti-war movement had sort of like had died, in a sense it didn't die, but it went underground and became much stronger than it was still in existence, but it was more like on a covert thing, and it came out much stronger.
I don't want to front like I know too much about anything. I'm just a student, and I'm coming into this very fresh. I don't know
We're
that much.
Too.
Okay, but and I haven't, like, the last time I went to Chiapas was when I was 11, so like I don't know that much about what's up. But I feel like when we're talking about resistance that's been happening in Chiapas and that's been happening in Argentina, I feel like. To say that when these resistance movements are happening, and that in kind of trying to say that because they're fighting or they're putting their efforts towards trying to stop their nations from acquiescing so much to globalization, to these different global institutions, to say that that's short-sighted, or that it's limited, and that it's an articulation that they still want those governments to be around, that they just want to reform them, and to say, you know, stop dealing with the IMF, stop dealing with things like NAFTA. I don't think that that's so much the case. Like, I feel like in those kinds of situations, because things are so dire, it seems like that's the direct thing that you're going to be challenging. And in Argentina, like one government, one president fell, another one fell, another one fell. I feel like people weren't saying that they wanted a new government that was going to be looking out for them. I felt like, you know, they were resisting directly those policies that were threatening them. But also, you know, with a larger vision too. Like, I feel like just because you're challenging that particular government doesn't mean that you're going to try to be advocating for another government to come up, you know, and to address those issues for you. I don't know. I don't know if I articulated that correctly, but
can we do a few more? Or you?
Can I?
We just decided last minute that I'd be facilitating, so it's kind of like, how much do we?
So very, very briefly, your point makes a lot of sense to me, and I think it's very perceptive. I would just make the distinction, the distinction I would like to point out is that the movements, for example, in Chiapas were primarily fighting, they were against global capital, but they're mobilized against the Mexican state primarily. Whereas I believe that the anti-globalization movement was much more, primarily in Canada, the United States, and Western Europe, were primarily oriented politically against these global institutions rather than, say, the French government per se or the Italian government. I just want to make that distinction. It's a very sensitive point.
I want to put a couple points. First of all, like, I agree with both speakers, and I'm not just saying that because Chuck is my ride back to New York City. Exactly. I love you, Chuck. There's a couple of things. I wanted to comment. I thought Marina made an excellent point in terms of, you know, opening in terms of desire and imagination are forced upon movements. A lot of times our desires are forced upon, a lot of times international movements. And a lot of times I feel that, there's a certain level of privilege in the global north that we have because we can kind of sit back and say, well, people are doing it, but we're not really doing it in our own communities. And I think that's kind of problematic, you know, and I think that it needs to be a kind of give and take. If you look at, two examples really quickly, 1968, Tet Offensive, transformed the movement, increased the movement, for social justice within this country, revolutionary moves within this country. Another example, Portugal, the anti-colonialism movement, or through the fascist regime, because the military defeats they had in Angola and Guinea-Bissau. So I think that there needs to be a back and forth in terms of, they need our support, as much as we need their support in terms of really building social movements. A comment I really want to make, and I kind of want to throw it as a question as well, is that there was a lot of talk about the issue of power, and I think that there's definitely a need for direction because capitalism creates its own dynamic, it creates its own gravity, and where movements are great in terms of really tapping into the spontaneity of a lot of people's energy, after a long time, people get tired, they have to go back to their work, they have to go back to their jobs, they need some stability in their lives. Recently, I read in the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago, I hope I'm saying this correctly, the Piquet Carlos movement in Argentina, there's a split between the middle class and the working class folks in the Piquet Carlos movement because certain, concessions were made, and now middle class folks are like saying to working class folks who are unemployed, we don't want you to do your roadblocks anymore, And so there's a kind of a schism there. So I guess my question, is in terms of I think that Chuck kind of brought out a little bit, is that if we're not dealing with questions of power, what are we really kind of dealing with in terms of organization and really kind of consolidating a lot of this energy that has been harnessed, in terms of the anti-globalization movement? Because I feel that if that energy is not consolidated, it becomes dissipated and people just kind of fall back into the regular roles within society.
Hi. I'm from Western Massachusetts. So I'd like to just say that I agree with Chuck in saying that it's dead, and I think that we should say it's dead, because I don't think that I think that we need to understand that it's not valueless because it's dead, and accept its lessons and move on. Because the problem with saying that it's alive is that it equates all the movements that you are saying stem from it as the same, basically. I mean, in a way, it just adds them all together. I think the anti-war movement is a really good example. You say, well, this is an example of an extension of the globalization movement. But not really. I mean, a lot of the people who are involved in the anti-war movement were really for UN inspections of Iraq, which I think a lot of us, would also say is awful. And I think that the movements all do have very, or not all of them, but have very different enemies. I don't think that they are all the same enemies. And I think that a lot of people, especially here at the Anarchism Conference, can readily accept that people who believe we're on their side or, we are fighting very different things.
I'll go back to the minute. There are two other hands, and then maybe I'll say a few things.
I think it's a really interesting debate about whether, on the one hand, we take this very long perspective and say there is this movement, that you could take back to the 1960s. Does it appear in different guises and gone on the ground at different point and appears at different point, which I'm kind of pretty sympathetic to. But also, I think maybe Chuck's got his finger on something, that there is something, especially in the United States, about the anti-globalization movement that is specific and might, for example, have to do with the life experiences of the group of people, or group of people who are very active in that movement, in particular young people who are of this generation are more oppressed than young people have been for several generations past, and people are frustrated with career options open to them and tried school for a few years and dropped out and went and lived in the countryside and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, Chuck may be putting his finger on something that's absolutely right, that there are some specific features of the anti-globalization movement of the 90s in the United States that do need to be pointed out. And I think it's a matter of social history, which in part can be done in a place like this, where you can talk to people who participated. And the second thing I want to say is I think it's also equally a matter of empirical research and a very interesting and important thing for us to look at, and that is how is radicalism passed on from one generation to another. And there's some pretty interesting stuff about this. For example, a lot of the 68 generation in Germany, you know, very quickly came to the limits of their movement, and what did they do? Well, they created what in Germany is called the alternative, which is food co-ops and collectives of all kinds, and created a really important infrastructure that was then in place when the next generation of struggles came along.
Hey, I'm from NYU, and again, I'm also a student, so this is all very new to me, but I just wanted to, I guess, maybe ask Chuck to elaborate a little bit about a point that you made in your response to Marina, where you mentioned the movement in Seattle and how, in your opinion, a lot of what kind of, killed it or passed it on to something else in history was the fact that it comprised of a number of different movements that didn't all share the same political ends, but they were all working together in that one historical moment for one particular, albeit maybe kind of spontaneous, you know, effort. But then, since they didn't have that particular shared goal, that kind of caused things to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be sort of this tricky balance between, you know, on one hand you have this fragmentation, but on the other hand, this need for spontaneity and almost maybe a degree of desperation in order for people to throw their energy towards any kind of direct action. Because like Kaz said, what perpetuates capitalism is this kind of apathy and exhaustion and people returning to their modern life. So I'm just wondering, like, is there room for that level of distinguishment between particular causes, or do people just need to throw some of their differences aside and kind of band together?
Mm-hmm. There was something I wanted to say as well, and kind of throw out a few questions that seem to be kind of trying to cluster questions of sorts, but I don't know if you wanted to say something to that just now, or you want to wait?
If it's okay, I'll respond.
Yeah,
okay. Really good question. It's a key point of argument. I appreciate you pointing that out. I believe that ambiguity about political aims forced this very specific and delimited movement to be dispersed. I disagree with the argument that we demonstrated, that the anti-globalization movement demonstrated what it was for by the way it acted and by the way it behaved. I think that the movement was able to show an affection or an interest in decentralized democratic alternatives. It could show that, but that I don't believe is a real alternative to the questions of political and economic power that we need to address in order to reconstruct society. I think it demonstrated a sensibility, but I don't think that is sufficient. I think it's important, but not sufficient. And in my opinion, I believe this addresses your question. I do not believe that ambiguity over the question of state power can be tolerated historically. In other words, some people have the guns and other people don't. And I believe that we should have the guns. I believe that the people should have the guns and that the government shouldn't. And that's an unambiguous question. But the Ralph Naders of the world, or the global exchange of the world, they say, well, I think the government should have the guns, but we're going to go to the protests, and we believe in direct action, all that. So in my opinion, I mean, I think the question that you raise is an important one to me. In my question over the issue of state power, there cannot be, over the issue of state power, over the right to determine the boundaries of a political community, over the right to regulate, to shape people's lives and our interaction with nature, there is, in a political sense, always one power, and it's either the one, the many, or the few, as it has been historically, and I believe it should be the many. So that's a very important question for me, and I think it's key. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
I mean, and that actually kind of gets on one of the things that I think in this, one of the pieces of the conversation, and it actually just reminded me as well, and thinking like, okay, I disagree with you on a lot, but there are places where I'm agreeing and trying to come to terms with what are some of these spaces. And I think one of them is the difference between a movement, a social movement, and an ideological organization that has, not a program, but that has a group of people who are coming together with a more specific agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be a useful conversation to have a little bit more, because I think there are two things, and we're blending them a lot in the conversation, and maybe other people don't think that. But there's a... So while I can agree with you as far as getting rid of the state, of course, but I'm part of lots of movements that might still be a question, or it's in all kinds of places, and I think that's okay. It's why it's a movement of movements, and I think there's a lot of different ideas in there. That's not to say we don't need the other piece, to have many different organizations as well, or collectives, so that... I'd like to remind folks, too, of what kind of brought out in this question of, I mean, it does in different places, I think, I mean, agreeing with you to some extent, that it does feel like sometimes there are, I mean, there are definitely fewer affinity groups in New York, where I'm from, and it can feel like that in different places. So are folks all in community organizations? Are people doing anti-war work? Where are people organizing? What are the different bases, and why does it maybe feel different? And to try to talk about that a little. And then the last kind of overarching... No, there's actually two. One is huge. It's kind of like the question of power and what is power and do you take power in whatever way? Are we creating alternate powers? And I think that is a big question in these conversations, and they relate again to kind of building an organization or movement. But then the last one, it is something I've been thinking about a lot more recently and maybe also having to do with spending time in Argentina, but it's this question of what is politics? You know, so what are you for? And I actually think politics isn't so much, okay, here is our ideology and this is what we do. And not to be all Gramscian, like it's, you know, the theory and practice coming together. But I think there is a politics that's being articulated through practice in different places around the world. And I think that, so just one little antidote is, you know, in doing interviews with folks, I was in this occupied factory in this printing press in Argentina, and Candido, you know, insists he's not political. But I actually think it's like the Zapatistas articulate a kind of politics of everyday existence. And I think it's more like that. It's, well, I'm not political because I don't have my political agenda and I'm not walking in with my plan. But what I'm doing is taking over factories and helping other people learn to take over factories. And so I think it's maybe one of the questions as well is kind of rethinking what is political and what does that mean. And I think it relates to this conversation of what is a movement as well. There's kind of lots of little questions out there.
I like the discussion about do we have philosophical requirements or what's the basis of unity. I was involved in some of the alliance building in the Direct Action Network leading up to Seattle, and to be perfectly blunt, had we had anarchist philosophical requirements, we wouldn't have been able to create the confrontation or shut down the WTO. We actually needed global exchange. We needed... a bunch of the different grassroots groups who don't identify as anti-authoritarian that plugged in. And I also agree with Jaggi that there is a little anarchist arrogance in thinking that, like, we anarchists are the whole movement, when in fact, you know, a big chunk of us are anti-authoritarians. A very small chunk of are people who primarily and centrally identify as anarchists. But I'm interested in... I still think it's necessary to try and find places, and what happened in that particular case is we were able to get a bunch of different movements and groups of people to converge and say, we're all going to do this one thing at this one place, and that created a good confrontation. And we still have to be able to do that with people who we don't necessarily agree with. And I think it's something that we need to get a lot more skills at. One thing that I think is one sector that we didn't converge with was community-based organizations, and has been pointed out a lot, the communities of color in Seattle weren't small sectors and a few handfuls of people, but there wasn't a large convergence from communities of color or much participation from community-based organizations in Seattle or that part of the Northwest in the direct action part. And that's something that is exciting to me, that both in Miami and in New York, those community-based organizations actually framed the mass mobilizations, identified stuff, and there has been a convergence. I've been learning a ton from, I've been making puppets with a coalition of Immokalee workers and watching how they organize and do popular education, and a lot of us have been learning a ton from them, so... I think that's actually one of the more hopeful things is trying to expand that ability to converge with people who we don't necessarily agree with, and I think a lot of us have been trying to figure out how to do the local organizing that Jaggi was talking about. The last two protests against the WTO in the Bay Area, where I'm from, we did them in conjunction with local environmental justice groups, at Chevron Texaco. And I guess the last thought I think about why I disagree with Chuck is that huge portions of the anti-war movement are anti-capitalist or anti-globalization or global justice, and most of us have an analysis that corporations and capitalism play a key part in that, and see that war is another form of globalization or another form of capitalism. So I think, you know, we've had millions of people marching in the streets, mass shutdowns, and some of us, at least in the Bay Area, were able to take mass actions and transform them so that when the action was over, no one went home because we all lived there. And so, to me, those are a couple hopeful areas.
I agree that our everyday lives need to show what kind of society we want. I think that, and I used not to think that way. I used to think that we needed a certain kind of structure that would get us there, and then we'll deal with it. But I changed my ways. I do agree that our everyday lives need to show this, and that's the only way we'll really build any sort of community, and that's the only way we'll really enact social change. But I also think that if you look at the movements that have been successful in the past, whatever success we call success, they always had a program, a political program. We are lacking that, and there's no use to try and make of that a virtue. We are just lacking that, and we've been lacking that theory for many, many years. So I think that that theory is not going to come out of a small group of people thinking on their own about how things are going to change. There's plenty of people who have very clear ideas about how things need to be. That is only going to happen when we are able to communicate those theories to people, and people agree with them, and they understand them, and they want to come with us and do it. So that's something we need to keep in mind. That's our biggest challenge, I think, right now, is that we don't have that theory, and our work needs to be with our communities to produce those theories. But we cannot just tell ourselves, well, we might not have the big program, but we have this great thing going on. Yeah, we do have that, and without that, we are never going to produce that. But we are lacking that, and that's something we need to think.
I would agree with what Graciela said very strongly and add that it's almost like we've gotten to this exhaustion of this idea of the personal as the political, and like really we should reduce what is the political, define it. And our movements now, you know, this whole turn to tactics and this turn away from politics is really, I think it's a great thing, but we shouldn't like just abandon the political, but we should narrow it and define it. The political should be what the political is, you know, and like that way we can define what our political agenda is. And kind of creating the world that we want and living the way we want has to be respected, but that shouldn't be viewed as political work. That's cultural work. That's living work. That's valuable, but it's not political, you know? And, like, leave politics as politics and culture as culture and stop blurring them. I think that's a very valuable thing that's going on right now. And that way we really notice the lack of political theory and the need to articulate that and can value what our strengths are, not as political theory, but as cultural work, or as whatever they specifically may be.
The energy's picking up in the room now. The debate's kind of like people are like, okay.
I don't like to speak up too many times, but I'm gonna try one more time to say what I was gonna say better. I don't want to make a really big assumption about what you're trying to say about confronting nations as opposed to confronting the larger global capital, but I feel like when we're talking about confronting global capital, we need to try to identify all of the different facets that it manifests itself. And, you know, when a nation participates in the IMF or participates in policies like NAFTA, it becomes an extension of, I think, global capital. And so when you're challenging that, you're challenging global capital, I feel like. And just because, you know, your actions might be locally centered to a specific border or to a specific community, to a state, to whatever it wants to, whatever it is, doesn't mean that it's not done with a consciousness of how it's connected to global capital. It doesn't mean that it is an active, you know, form of resisting global capital. I feel like resistance to globalization, as we're trying to do, doesn't necessarily always happen by attending and trying to protest at and shut down an IMF event or something, or a WTO event, that it happens all over the place, whether it's within a classroom and it's, you know, trying to empower students to see a different perspective on things, whether it's happening, you know, in your direct community or going to these events. Like, not all people can make it out to, you know, a WTO meeting or things like that. And that's not the only avenue for resisting, I think. And I don't know, I just think that we need to explore very creative new ways of resisting. It's not all just like shut down.
Hi. I'm speaking partly because other than the panelists, there's only been one woman who's spoken, so my thoughts aren't completely together, and I also missed most of the panel, so I have no idea what Chuck said and whether or not I agree with Chuck. But I'm just going to throw out some ideas anyways, and I guess the first thing I wanted to say was that I don't really care if the anti-globalization movement or whatever it's called is alive and dead, because for me that's a label that's, it's completely irrelevant, because I agree that it didn't start in Seattle, and I agree that it hasn't ended since, say, Montreal, when our like last protest brought out maybe like 80% less of the people it would have 4 years ago. I mean, to me that's like just a really North American-centric way of seeing the movement, so I think that this debate about whether or not the movement is dead or not is irrelevant. And I think, I guess I come from kind of the same point of view as Jaggi, probably because we live in the same city to some extent. But and I also, I was pretty active in, say, fighting the WTO, and then I left North America for 2 years, and then I came back to a completely different situation. And I like our movement much better right now. It's smaller, people are burned out, we're cranky, some of us take 3 months off to like go look at like seagulls in the ocean and do whatever, but I think that the challenges that we've been faced with and the conceptual and practical issues that we face now and the way we look at things is so much deeper than it was around the time in Seattle, where whether or not we like it, it was cool to be an anti-globalization activist, and you know, Madonna had people dressed up as protesters dancing on stage with her. And so now, when we look, we've gone beyond summit hopping, and the capitalism that we're fighting and the institutions we're fighting, it's all very vague and it's hard to put our finger on, and the WTO is crumbling, so we can't just stay down with the WTO anymore. And all these things push us further, and they have forced us in Montreal, or not forced us, they've led us to strengthen some of the local struggles. And what we've found is that a lot of these local struggles that we're working in, we, and I say we as people maybe from who define themselves as anti-globalization activists before they sat down and really thought about things, or we as in the people who are organizers who are sitting in this room. And so when people around me have been organizing with local communities, all of a sudden you see people who 4 years ago were saying, we're radical, we're not for reforms, pushing for reforms to the immigration system, or pushing for reforms to, in Canada, laws that have basically devastated the self-determination of Indigenous peoples. And so for me, this is forcing us to really look at what we're asking and look, ask much deeper questions, because the whole question of whether or not we're anarchists or not, and whether we're pushing for reforms or not, and whether we want to stay or not, it's really, really important to think about these issues. But at the same time, we do that when we're in a position of privilege, right? Because we're not necessarily facing deportation tomorrow. If I was about to be removed tomorrow, I would be fighting for either my own case or a reform to immigration law. And then it's from there that people start to make deeper links and that we start to ask questions. But I think we have to be very open to that as well and not so purist in defining ourselves. And the last thing I want to say, and then I'll shut up, I really didn't mean to talk this long, is the whole personal versus political dichotomy. I think that also brings us back to privilege, because for instance, I went to university in a very relatively wealthy town in southern Ontario, and a special alternative program where we were all told that you have to live according to your values and the personal is political, and na-na-na-na-na. But once again, I was not a single mother raising six children, you know? And I think that like some of the choices that we made, and we were very proud of ourselves for eating organic cereal and whatnot, that's fine, but you can do that in a situation of privilege. So I think when we separate political and you know, personal in that way. I think we have to really ask ourselves where it is we're standing and what kind of privilege we're living.
I'm going to do a... So we have like 15 minutes. People are cool for staying another like 10 minutes or so? Is that... There's some hands that we're looking for. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. What I want to say, I really didn't think that what Chuck said and Marina had to say were that much opposed. I think maybe they're talking about different aspects of the anti-globalization movement. And the two analyses do fit together. And how I look at it is that any kind of movement of resistance is always going to be co-opted. And there's an awful lot of co-optation going on right now. And the seeds of that co-optation were there right from the beginning in Seattle. So everything that Chuck is saying, I can see that happening in Calgary, where we had the G8 a couple of years back, the G8 protests. They were very depoliticized protests, and I was involved with a group there too, and the group just broke down right after the protests. It was all tactical and strategical, and it just got bogged down. I tried to initiate a political discussion, and I couldn't after the protests were over. So I can totally identify with what Chuck is saying. And I think large segments of the anti-globalization movement, right from the beginning, there's a political culture right now that is working to resist any kind of radical analysis of globalization. But that's not to say that at the same time this is total. So there's still a lot of people who are becoming more radicalized. And maybe that's where Marina is coming in. You know, there's still that element there who are developing an analysis. And this may differ in certain parts of the world. In Calgary, that element is minuscule. but, you know, in some parts of the South where the contradictions of globalization are stronger, that element can be a lot stronger. And I'm seeing some pretty sophisticated analysis coming out, talking about the different approaches to anti-globalization. And there is a whole spectrum of politics. And we're not all opposing globalization for the same reasons. And there's some very conservative, not just reformist, but conservative trends in the anti-globalization movement. And some of those trends are quite popular for a lot of reasons among alienated middle-class Westerners. But some of the same trends are also taking root in some countries in the South, among elites in the South, too. So, you know, I think it's important. You both had very important points to make, and, you know, it's not a matter of lining up with one or the other. I think the two analyses are very complementary.
We're trying to be like Marx and Bakunin, so.
Who am I?
Actually, I don't know who I'd want to.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, God, thank you.
There were a few other.
Jackie.
Yeah, go ahead. If it's okay, just because you haven't spoken yet.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is not to speak to global resistance, but to talk about like U.S. protest culture. Very specifically to U.S. national mobilizations and how they function and how people feel about them afterward and what they do. And, like, they're really, I mean, there's just been a huge shift, obviously, like, between the last RNC and the one 4 years ago and then the one this year. Even though this one was much bigger, I mean, and then again, like, the whole RNC protest is really, like, a problematic politic because... Even though everyone's like, well, I don't want a president at all, but here I am anyway. We're all protesting this anyway at the same time. So we all feel, like, conflicted about what we're doing, but we still want to be there for some reason. We don't know why. But just the kind of thing about, like, the cops being our own propaganda machine. You know, like, they're our own propaganda machines, like you were saying. And it kind of seems like, yeah, that if you're using that as a marker of, you know, dead or alive kind of thing, it does... It kind of struck me like, yeah, maybe it is dead if that's one of our markers. Because, sure, in Miami, I mean, the cops used, like, extremely brute force more than at any of the other protests in the past 5 years in the U.S., but no one knew about it except for us, and we watched the Miami model or whatever, or we watched indie media. But you ask, like, tons of people, liberal-leaning people, like, all kinds of people, like, did you hear about what happened in Miami? They're like, no. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Did not make a dent. And then the cops in New York, I mean, to me, like, I left there, and I was like, they won. They arrested a lot of people. It didn't make any sense because people didn't actually do very much. And they were very obedient, ultimately, or we were very obedient, pretty much. But they were very well behaved, from my observation. Like, the cops were not out of control at all. They weren't even, most of the time, even dressed out of control, like the way they often do at mass mobilization. So it did make it feel like, yeah, they already know that there's, like, a bottom line, like, no property destruction already, like, inside the organizing. Like, there's all these things going on that make it feel like, yeah, I mean, what, we've become more and more obedient as the years go on or something. I don't know. And I thought maybe people might want to talk a little bit, because I haven't really processed the RNC with many people, except for, like, the 5 people I was there with, and we all kind of felt extremely depressed, even though on indie media people are like, we won, it was amazing, you know. And I'm like, what did we win? I don't know. Just kind of, I don't know what other people feel. That's all.
That's a good point.
Robin, were you going to say something about Philly and New York?
Sorry. Well, it was completely different. Yeah, it was, I wasn't in New York on the day of direct action, so I didn't really see what happened. But yeah, Philadelphia just seemed like a big, repressive, crazed thing that happened, but it did actually get attention around the world, I think. And there was a lot in the papers for a long time after that, and was kind of maintained in the news. And the legal collective, who did all this work, did some amazing things. But there was a sense that something had happened, whereas it seemed like in New York there wasn't so much of a sense like that something had happened, that, like, there was all this anticipation that this would really mean something around the world, and people would respond to it. And it was just kind of like a blip I don't imagine it felt that way for people who were directly involved, but it seemed like it was just kind of it kind of fizzled out.
Maybe we should organize a discussion, whether it's during a meal or some, like, breakout time. I don't know how we do that, or if there's paper or something, to have a kind of conversation about it, because I'm just going to say, like, a quick, because my sense in New York as well, and having been in Philly, but it felt to me like a very different kind of repression. So that the way people were brutalized in jail in Philly is different than the kind of fear that went on because of the infiltration in New York. I've never felt people around me in affinity groups and spokes councils as, like, who's the cop? When are they going to raid us? When are they going to arrest us? When are they going to hurt us? I mean, it was this level, because of a level of infiltration and this blimp flying over us with the secret, you know, it was just kind of massive. A different kind of oppression, I guess, is what
I'm thinking. Philadelphia actually felt like a battle, like, on the street. Like, there were people, there were the protesters, and then there were the police, and it felt like you were ready to, like, have this big battle engagement, but both sides were prepared. In New York, it seemed like a different kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually, yeah, very few minutes, and I feel like now we've started 2 conversations, and Jagged had his hand up a while ago on, I think, the what is political conversation.
There's been a lot of good points, but I guess I want to build on what Tamara was saying, because I was kind of building what I was saying, and I just want to bring that point forward, because it's not to reject this debate. It's to say that, to take off on what you were saying, like, about, you know, comparing New York and Philly and this. It's an interesting discussion, but that side of struggle is almost a set piece for the media. There are other sites of struggle that we've discovered and people have been talking about since Seattle or wherever back you want to go, where, as Tamara was saying, immigrants, refugees fighting deportation. 5,000 people were detained after September 11th, on spurious things. There are people on trial or people who are detained in Canada right now without knowing the charges against them, etc. And the families that are organizing, the communities that are organizing around them, those of us who are acting as allies with them, that's a side of struggle, and we're talking, you know, about a lot of terms about, like, the idea of the state, and how will the state wither away, or how do we get rid of the state, etc. But there's other anarchist concepts at play here: self-determination, organizing, how we organize. So we've talked about politics and tactics, and I really have no problem about the nature of that discussion, that maybe we've overemphasized tactics over politics, but the organizational vehicles that we have and how we organize, and there's profound examples in communities in North America of people who are engaging in profound acts of self-determination, of organizing that resembles what we would support, that I think we need to give space to. So we're analyzing RNC or things that go on in the anti-globalization movement in terms of how we're scaring the authorities and how we're taking on the cops or how we're getting into the media. And meanwhile, there's all these incredible examples of autonomy and self-organization in action. I won't bother to give, you know, a whole slew of them, but like just a few that some of us in Montreal are really close to is the community in Kanesitake that's taken on their cops, that's asserting itself as a community and asked for outside support. Immigrant and refugee populations in Montreal. When Tamara talked about how sometimes it seems reformist, and it is, you know, you're fighting a deportation, it seems reformist, but meanwhile, we're taking to the streets people who, when they take to the streets, have a lot more to risk, and are chanting things like no borders, no nation, stop the deportations. Mm-hmm. And not just chanting it, but articulating an analysis. A lot of the refugees have spoken out about how deportation should be seen as a human rights abuse, how nation states are set up, you know, to basically create a system of apartheid worldwide. Those are really profound contributions to a debate that comes out of struggle. So I'm not saying this to replace a debate or anything, but to maybe say where some people are at. And so I kind of agree with how Tamara put it, although it might have seemed a bit undiplomatic. I don't know if people saw it that way, but some of us from Montreal come across that way sometimes because somebody put it like it's about U.S. and Canadian, by the way. It's not that Canada's any better, but about a protest culture, which is the point I was trying to make before. It's about a protest culture when people are trying to learn some lessons and continue with this debate. So I agree with the other point that there's a lot of complementary things being said. And I guess even posing the argument that the anti-globalization movement is dead, you know, prods us into sort of not validating something that you know, has taken on a whole other shape, but maybe giving some space and allowing us to articulate where we see self-determination and autonomy and all these other values that are core to us as anarchists being practiced, and why a lot of anarchists aren't so interested in being anarchists as anarchists or going to the big protests, although we support those things and we think they're great, but we're practicing a certain type of direct solidarity with those sites of struggle. And I've only limited myself to North America because, again, I go back to Palestine and about the certain effect that had on certain people in the anti-globalization movement, though, people fighting for the basics. And knowing that here, talking about the U.S. now, that there's a direct link and really calling ourselves on that. And even within Palestine, which is a national liberation movement, there's a whole bunch of problems where people within that movement, Palestinians, Arabs themselves, are saying, let's not confuse a state with liberation. I've been told that in various different ways by a lot of different people. And that starts a conversation with directly affected people that can go somewhere. And I think maybe we need to get to that point, and then we can have the bigger discussion where we generalize our hatred of the state, where we generalize our hatred of empire, etc., etc., and where we're side to side with those directly affected people. Something that I'm going to explore a bit in another workshop, just to promote it.
We have it's actually 10, and there are a bunch of hands that have gone up. So, as far as suggestions of what to do we want to take a few hands and then the hands that are up and then close, or we want to close and make an informal discussion?
Another two more.
So you pick two out of the three that are up. Pick two out of the three.
Man,
are people cool with taking the last three, and then even if it spurs like most, you know, we just like hold it in for a second, we close, and then now we all know each other, we can talk informally. Is there a fire or something afterward too, or a place that people go and are all?
We're going to do a mailing of perspectives on anarchist theory, and I would like to request as much assistance as possible.
And there's free beer and snacks.
I'm not joking. No. Yeah, we're going to do a fucking mailing. Yeah.
This is where we differ in our politics.
Chuck is
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's going to be. I'm sure there's fires and stuff.
We'll fold them by the fire. Okay. So the last, it was one, two, and Nagam, you had your hand up too?
Like a long time ago. It's before we got.
Okay, so it is two out of the three. There you go. Yes.
My point was just quick. Like one thing that I would come away from a discussion like this, and that I hope that other people would think about, is that I mean, again, we kind of framed it in an odd way of, like, you know, something that had, like, a, you know, a movement that has kind of a determined time frame. And I think we've kind of, like, put it in a very odd time frame of being, like, a decade or so. But I was pretty inspired by a demonstration that happened pretty recently, just outside of Vancouver in British Columbia. There's a demonstration against a resort that's being built on native lands there. And I mean, it only attracted, I mean, there were, I think, about 200 people there, and it definitely didn't look like any of these demonstrations we've seen against, you know, the global capitalist institutions. But I think the point that it underlined is that there's been this struggle here on this land, and it's over 500 years old, and it's always been there, and it will continue to be there so long as, you know, these phenomena we see today continue, and, you know, people who are oppressed by capitalism, by colonialism, will keep fighting those. And again, like, it's kind of odd for us to sit in a room talking about, like, you know, how anarchists are contributing to that. But I think that, I mean, there is a value in the sense that, like, I think that we need to recognize, you know, I think we need to almost be humble in a sense that, like, we're not the be-all and the end-all of the movement. The struggle is always there, and to at least give it that dignity in recognizing its long history and the fact that it will continue.
I would like to just address something that Jaggi said real quickly, and that, you know, you said a lot of people are saying to you that you know, the formation of a new state is not liberation, and I also wonder, though, if we often confuse a movement for liberation as well, and I don't think that it always is. And I think that this is how we should go back to what we were saying before about the personal and the political and this debate, which, you know, may seem tired to some of us. But I do think that if the place for the personal beat a political is within the movement itself, when you're in a broader movement, living out the personal as political is something that is very valuable. So, you know, if you are in an anti-governmental movement in Syria, as one of my friends is, but are also a homosexual, it makes it very difficult to not be political, you know, every day just by being gay and saying that that's a political act. Because if you don't, what happens after you win your battle, which it doesn't look like they're going to win their battle against the Syrian government, of course, I mean, it's a much stronger repression than here, is that, you know, you win and you're still fucked. So, I mean, I think that within the movement, that's where the place for that is. And I just...
Well, if we're up to me, we would do, like, a closing, and I'm not sure the best way. If we're up to Chuck, we probably would. So maybe we'll compromise, and you don't even know what I would... Uh-huh. We would, like, all hold hands, and no, I'm not sure what we would do. But I think, actually, we'll probably just... If folks would break... I do want to say one thing, though, just on the personal and political, just, I think, in part because I've been thinking so much about what is politics, and that... Just in my framework, and some people, I guess, might frame it in the question of the personal is political or is it not, but that's not actually how I'm thinking about it. I think when I'm thinking about the political as every day and it's on our experiences, that's a different kind of question than is it political for me, the personal being political, than we're living politics every day and that part of our theory is in our experience and seeing them closer together. It's just pressing on me too much and using privilege of being able to facilitate. But... So if someone wants to suggest a closing, we could do that.
Can I just make a comment? Not about political.
Oh.
I just wanted to thank you all for coming and offering your comments. I learned a lot. I really do learn a lot from it. It's hard to figure out where things, you know, where we're at, where things begin, where things end, where the central issues are. And I'm really grateful for all of your comments, especially those who agreed with me. genuinely, I'm grateful. So I just want to express my gratitude.
This has been a recording of Chuck Morse and Marina Citron and many other activists debating the life or death of the anti-globalization movement. They spoke at the 2004 Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference at Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont on September 24th, 2004. Thanks for listening.